deny the petition so we can talk about those.
Okay, is there anything they haven't granted any, have they?
No, no, they haven't.
When Tom Schreiner and Pete Blaine tell us about what the Supreme Court has been up to, and this past term in bankruptcy, they have been very busy. So I'm very excited to hear about all the cases. Next month, our second favorite, I don't know, they're very close in my mind. It's the ethics presentation with Paula's Cookies. That's December 8th. Mark Metz and Olivier Ryer are going to update us on ethics and discuss ethics, and we'll get our ethics credit, yay, for all of us that are recording this year. That's helpful, and you get the cookies. So come on back, December 8th. We're back to our second Tuesday. We don't have anything lined up for January yet, but we're thinking new forms. Anton, yeah, so we're going to look for somebody who's going to, there's new forms coming in December 1st. I'm sure you're familiar with them and are going to be hearing more and more about them as we get closer, but maybe in January we'll look for a topic there. So keep coming back to the Lou Jones Breakfast. Thank you so much for your support through the year, and thanks to our speakers, Tom Schreiner and Pete Blaine.
Well, as the judge said, there were the court was very active in the last session. They decided five cases, six actually, because two were decided together, and a whole range of issues, including some significant jurisdictional issues. And we're going to go through each of those cases, and at the end, tell you kind of what's coming up. Although no petitions have been granted, there are some interesting petitions that are pending that might, you know, further give us some discussion for next year. Tom?
Yeah, let me start, but let me also suggest at the front end that as we talk about the five cases or five opinions that the court issued last year in bankruptcy, think about these cases, I think about them anyway, in terms of bedrock principles, because I think with the possible exception of one of the cases, each of these ultimately ends up getting resolved on the basis of a bedrock principle that you might expect the U.S. Supreme Court would revert to. Some of those principles have very little to do with bankruptcy, two of them anyway, but of course come up in the course of a bankruptcy case, so they were decided in that context. Which is to say that not all of these really are, I think, broad areas of bankruptcy significance. Although, again, you know, those principles get resolved. One of them, which we'll talk about in the middle of the pack, wellness, the latest appearance of the Stern versus Marshall, or if you're really an old timer, Northern Pipeline versus Marathon issue. It certainly has some bedrock principles embodied in it, but there's a struggle going on in the court and between adherence to what some of the justices see as those bedrock principles and another bedrock principle, which is pragmatism. The system has to work. So we'll get into that. But think about that as we go through the cases. And let me start by talking about Bullard versus Blue Hills Bank. Here, the bedrock principle I suggest to you is the final judgment rule. This arose in the context of a Chapter 13 proceeding, so it's a bankruptcy case, certainly. But the issue the court ultimately decided really has to do with the principle we learned in first-year civil procedure, you know, the 1291 of the Judicial Code, the final decision, final judgment, final order rule. There will only be one appeal in a case. Here the debtor filed a Chapter 13 and a plan in which he proposed to split an undersecured creditor's mortgage lender's claim into a secured claim, which he would repay over a long period of time, whatever was remaining in the life of the mortgage loan, and an unsecured claim, which would be partially paid over the life of the plan. 10% perhaps. The bank objected, as Chief Justice Tom or Robert says, no surprise there. And the bankruptcy court in Boston denied confirmation, holding that the debtor couldn't split the claim unless he proposed to pay the secured portion over the life of the plan. There was a difference of view on this within the First Circuit. Some bankruptcy courts had allowed this kind of a plan. Others had not. The debtor appealed from the denial of confirmation of the Chapter 13 plan. And the First Circuit BAP, they have a bankruptcy appellate panel there, concluded that an order denying confirmation of a debtor's plan was not a final order because the debtor was free to propose an alternative plan. But the BAP exercised its discretion, which it has, as the district court does, to allow an interlocutory appeal under 158A3 because the dispute did involve a controlling issue of law as to which there was substantial ground for difference of opinion and the resolution of it would materially advance the litigation, or so the BAP thought. And then on the merits, the BAP affirmed the bankruptcy court. The debtor then appealed to the First Circuit, but the BAP hadn't certified the appeal under those criteria, important issues, substantial ground for difference of opinion, and so on. And so the First Circuit dismissed the appeal from the BAP because it said that the only basis for an appeal from the BAP would be that there was a final order in the bankruptcy court that could have been appealed to the BAP. There was First Circuit precedent saying no appeal to the Court of Appeals from the BAP unless there could have been an appeal as a final order from the bankruptcy court. So the Supreme Court granted cert on the case, and the issue was whether an order denying confirmation was a final order that the debtor can immediately appeal. If it had been, then the BAP would have had jurisdiction, the First Circuit would have had jurisdiction contrary to its holding. And so Chief Justice wrote the opinion, noting that requiring a final order for an appeal of right prevents piecemeal prejudgment appeals, which impede efficient judicial administration. However, again, this is standard lore. Bankruptcy, as we know, involves an aggregation of controversies, which in many cases could be standalone lawsuits, but for the fact that the debtor is a bankrupt. And 158A authorizes appeals of right from final judgments, much like 1291 does. And the debtor argued that each time the bankruptcy court reviews a plan, it conducts a separate proceeding, arguing that proceeding is the process of considering plans and that that culminates when the plan is either confirmed or the case is dismissed. The court agreed, each time the court reviews a plan, it's a separate proceeding. The bank, on the other hand, argued that the proceeding is the process, the larger process of confirming plans, and that that only culminates either when a plan is confirmed or when the case is dismissed. Court agreed with the bank, the Supreme Court agreed with the bank, unanimous decision, that only confirmation of a plan or dismissal of the case alters the status quo between the debtor and others and fixes the rights and obligations of the parties. While denial of confirmation, coupled with dismissal, like confirmation, changes and fixes the rights and obligation of the parties, denial with leave to amend the plan changes little and therefore is not final. Textually, the court looked to the laundry list of core proceedings in 157B and found one of them as that the bankruptcy court has core jurisdiction with respect to confirmations of plans. And the court said, well, it didn't say absence or denial of confirmation was something it had core jurisdiction of. So there was some evidence there, although the court acknowledged that it was weak, that the larger confirmation process was the proceeding, not each ruling on a specific plan. And the court then went on to say that to allow appeals of the denial of each plan could extend the case by years, pointing out that it had taken well over a year to get this one to the point where it was, and that avoiding such a result is a reason for the rule of finality, which has special importance in bankruptcies, which aren't supposed to hang around forever. There were arguments made by the debtor and on the debtor's behalf that debtors rarely have the money or incentive to mount multiple appeals, but the court pointed out that the same statutory language would apply in Chapter 11, where debtors were more likely to do so. So it was concerned about that. The court said the debtor isn't unfairly hurt by the inability to appeal the denial of a plan because the debtor has the right and retains the right to modify plans. The debtor is the only one that can propose a plan or modify it. And furthermore, that it just lets people know what the rules are, and that knowing that there's no appeal of right will give the debtor incentive to develop a confirmable plan. Didn't care much about the argument by the Solicitor General that this was asymmetrical, pointing out that there's a lot of asymmetry in the law, in particular with respect to the final judgment rule, the final appeal rule. Court used a phrase, Chief Justice Roberts used a phrase in response to the argument about the burdensomeness of not being able to appeal that I thought was interesting, and Pete did too when he wrote the outline because he put it in quotes, that certain burdensome rulings are only imperfectly reparable by the appellate process. And I wonder where that came from. It was in quotes, so the Chief Justice hadn't made it up, and I found it in the Digital Equipment Corporation versus Desktop Direct Inc. case of 1994. Interestingly, a case argued and lost by John Roberts. An appeal there from a decision by the lower courts not to enforce a settlement agreement. There had been a trademark dispute, and there had been a settlement, and as a result of the settlement, the case had been dismissed by on stipulation, but one party came back and said, well, I was defrauded in the settlement process, set aside the dismissal. The lower courts did, and the issue before the Supreme Court was whether there should be an appeal of right as from a final judgment on that order. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Souter, unanimously held that that was not a final decision for purposes of appeal. So the bedrock principle here is one appeal. And if it doesn't fit very well with bankruptcy, well, too bad. The court points out, and I think this is fair, that unlike in many civil cases, there are opportunities to appeal as a matter of discretion. Either the district court in our circuit or the BAP in the First Circuit can grant leave to appeal and can seek certification in our circuit at any rate to appeal to the Court of Appeals from the district court's adverse decision under 1292B. I couldn't do that with a BAP because 1292B doesn't talk about BAPs. It's appeals from district courts. So we are in a regime and will remain there, I think, in which the denial of confirmation of a plan is not appealable of right, and in which if there is an important issue there, you need to persuade the trial judge or the appellate court to hear the appeal as a matter of discretion rather than of right.
Tom, with the reference to Chapter 11, do you think the decision applies to Chapter 11
sure.
confirmation cases?
I think it does, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Our next case is Harris v. Viglin, which is a Chapter 13 case in which the court took up the issue of who is entitled to undistributed plan payments made from wages. In February of 2010, the debtor filed a Chapter 13 petition and confirmed a plan whereby he was to pay the trustee about $530 a month to be divided to his primary secured mortgage lender, Chase Bank, a small secured lender, and the balance to unsecured creditors. During the course of the case, the debtor fell behind on its mortgage payments. Chase lifted the stay and foreclosed on the home, but the wage payments continued during the course of the Chapter 13.
Until conversion, right?
Until he converted in November of 2010, at which time the Chapter 13 trustee had about $5,500 of undistributed wages on hand. And 10 days after the conversion, she paid herself, paid the debtor's counsel, and distributed the rest to the creditors.
There's a lesson coming for Chapter 13 trustees.
That's right. Debtor said Chapter 13 trustee had no authority to do that, and they wanted a refund of the undistributed wages.
And the refund was going to come from the trustee.
Chapter 13 trustee, unless you could get it back from the
unless
creditor.
You could get it back, right.
The bankruptcy court granted the motion and the district court affirmed, but the Fifth Circuit reversed, saying that the considerations of equity and policy really rendered the creditor's rights superior to that of the debtor. The Fifth Circuit acknowledged that the Third Circuit had gone the other way and had ruled that undistributed post-petition wages must be returned to the debtor on conversion, thus a circuit court split. So the issue was whether a debtor who exercised the absolute right to convert a 13 to a 7 is entitled to the post-petition wages and the possession of the Chapter 13 trustee upon conversion. Justice Ginsburg, again writing for a unanimous court, noted that individual debtors have several paths available to them. Among them are Chapter 7, in which all of the non-exempt property is collected and distributed to creditors, but post-petition wages are available to the debtor to allow the debtor to have a fresh start. Chapter 13, however, allows the debtor to retain certain property, but the debtor is required to apply post-petition wages to the Chapter 13 plan. The court noted that Chapter 13 plans are often unsuccessful, and therefore Congress afforded the debtors an absolute right to convert from a 13 to a 7 at any time. Conversion, the court said, doesn't commence a new case, but puts the case on a different track from 13 to 7. And at that time, under Section 348, the Chapter 13 trustee is dismissed, and a Chapter 7 trustee replaces her. The court noted that prior to the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 1994, courts were following three different paths. Some courts said the money goes back, undistributed wages in the hands of the Chapter 13 trustee goes back to the debtor. Some courts said it goes to the creditors pursuant to the Chapter 13 plan. And other courts said no, it has to be turned over to the Chapter 7 trustee for distribution to creditors under the Chapter 7. But the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 1994 added Section 348F1A, which provided that upon conversion, the estate is comprised of property as of the date of the petition. And there's a mistake in the outline on page 4 in paragraph 5 that should be petition instead of conversion. I apologize. The court noted that this would exclude post-petition wages. However, if the initial petition, Chapter 13 petition, was filed in bad faith, the statute specifically says the property of the estate is all property as of the date of the conversion, which would include post-petition wages not yet distributed. The court said that this distinction means that funds that a Chapter 13, now 7 debtor would have had the case been commenced as a 7, really are its property and not available to the creditors. The court noted that Section 348E terminates the services of the Chapter 13 trustee, and despite this, the trustee in this case distributed the money to herself, to debtor's counsel, and the creditors. The Chapter 13 trustee argued that Section 1327A provides that a confirmed plan binds the debtor and each creditor, and instructs the Chapter 13 trustee to distribute the money pursuant to the plan. The court said, no, no. When there's a conversion, these sections don't apply, or this section doesn't apply. Once the debtor exercised his statutory right to convert to a Chapter 7, the former Chapter 13 trustee lacked any authority to distribute any payments in accordance with the plan. The Chapter 13 trustee said, well, what about Bankruptcy Rule 1019, which requires winding up of the Chapter 13 estate? And the court said, no, that doesn't support paying creditors pursuant to a plan either. Creditors in a Chapter 13 case converted to a 7 have no vested rights to the funds in the hands of the Chapter 13 trustee. The court rejected the Chapter 13 trustee's argument in this case that this plan provided that the property did not revest in the debtor on confirmation, but remained property of the estate. The court said that under that formulation, that was misreading the statute, and creditors had no right to the property, even if it remained property of the estate, till it was actually distributed. Finally, the court rejected the Fifth Circuit's characterization of the debtor's reclaiming property in the hands of the Chapter 13 trustee as providing him with a windfall, because the court said there is no windfall. Had he started as a Chapter 7 debtor in the first place, he would have been entitled to all of his post-petition wages, which would have allowed him to get a fresh start. The court concludes by saying the way creditors can protect themselves is by insisting that a requirement be placed in the plan that the trustee promptly distribute any funds that it has, rather than allowing them to accumulate. And the court reversed and remanded to the lower court with that.
And I think the bedrock principle that I mentioned earlier in this case is, as it often is in bankruptcy cases in the Supreme Court, the plain meaning rule when interpreting a statute. 348F really requires this result. And as in some of the other cases, Bullard, for example, the one I just talked about, you can make an argument that it doesn't work very well, but that's what the statute says. It's what 158A says about appeals from final decisions. It's what 348F says about the effect of conversion, and you know, take up your problems with Congress, right?
And we'll talk about the plain meaning rule in a different context in the Caulquette case
up. We won't talk about it very much in wellness because this whole subject of the authority of bankruptcy judges as judges who are not protected by the constitutional protections in Article 3 of the Constitution with tenure during good behavior and inability to have compensation reduced by Congress, appointment by the President, confirmation by the Senate. Judges who don't have those protections, the question has been what can they do, what can't they do? Obviously, and this becomes important to the court in the wellness decision, that describes not just bankruptcy judges, but magistrate judges, a point that the court hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about in its earlier decisions, or at least talking about in its earlier Northern Pipeline and Stern decision, really plays an important part, I think, in this case. The other principle, there's a struggle here. The bedrock principle here is Article 3, particularly what Justice Brennan talked about in his plurality opinion in Northern Pipeline, what the Chief Justice talked about in his 5-4 in Stern, this bedrock principle that the judicial branch needs to be protected from the other branches encroaching on the core business of what the judicial power of the United States is and how the federal courts carry that out. The key to that being, I think, from those cases, that only an Article III judge can enter a judgment in the normal course of things, at least in a dispute that involves someone who's not the bankrupt and a claim to the right, to affect the rights of someone who is not a debtor. But the struggle that has arisen in the court, it's actually been around since Northern Pipeline, is between that bedrock principle, which always raises the question, but who's getting protected by it? You know, this abstract notion of protecting the system, which you might expect would appeal to somebody sitting on the Supreme Court, guardians of the system, a lot of that in Chief Justice Roberts' dissent, that bedrock principle runs right up against another principle, which is the trains have got to run, right? The pragmatic fact is that we've got bankruptcy courts, we've got bankruptcy judges doing a lot of work that district judges frankly don't want to do. We all know that. That's why we have bankruptcy courts in some respects. We've got magistrate judges doing a lot of work that district judges want them to do, and you know, how do those things work out? Are we going to go back to square one? Remember the discussion back in Northern Pipeline. we started from the proposition that that pure principle of the Article III judicial power of the United States, it's all Article III says, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as Congress may from time to time establish. That core principle was violated from the beginning. We had to have courts in the territories. We had to have courts in the District of Columbia. Nobody wanted them to be have the judges there to have life tenure because the territories weren't going to stay around that long. We've had non-Article III courts exercising a portion of the judicial power of the United States in military throughout the history of the United States in courts martial. And most importantly, probably, and most maddeningly to Justice Scalia, in something called the public rights area, which is to say administrative agencies of one form or another, certainly are out there exercising the judicial power of the United States, making decisions that affect people and lead to their having to pay money to somebody else without life tenure. The commissioners of the National Labor Relations Board, the board members are not life tenured Article III judges. The commissioners of the Securities Exchange Commission are not life tenured Article III judges. Importantly for this case, the commissioners of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the subject of the case in 1986, are not life tenured Article III judges, although they're doing something that clearly is exercising a portion of the judicial power of the United States, even as narrowly defined in Northern Pipeline, to enter a final judgment affecting someone's private rights. We get into these discussions about the fact that the rights derive from state law. I always wondered why that's important. Well, it's because it's sort of the core definition of what your private rights are. You know, your right to hold on to your property. Most assaults on that come through contract and tort litigation, which comes from state law. And really what these cases, I think, are about the ideal that when a federal court does those things, it ought to be an Article III court, and yet it never has been. Certainly hasn't been for a very long time. So how do we live with that? How do we align those things? When the new bankruptcy courts were created in 1978 and a plurality of four, written for by Justice Brennan and joined in by Justices Rehnquist and O'Connor, agreed that there was something the matter with that newly created court system, which basically hadn't gotten started yet. All the judges on it were still holdover bankruptcy judges, the old referees under the Bankruptcy Act of 1898. The idea was, well, you can't go out and sue someone for, it was a breach of contract case, and bring them in and make them pay money to the bankrupt in front of somebody who's not an Article III judge. So we got the fix. We got the bankruptcy, whatever it is, Judges Reform Act of 84, which gave us essentially the current system that we have, that picked up some language from Northern Pipeline and talked about core proceedings that were really tied up with the process of restructuring the debtor's financial situation and restructuring the relationship between the debtor and the debtor's creditors as being something that could be delegated under the public rights doctrine to a non-Article III judge and handled by a non-Article III judge, but not the entry of final judgment. This is where we got with Stern then in 2011. Same court as we had in 2011 still sitting today, no change in personnel, and yet different result, arguably, in the wellness court. Because one of the issues that arose in wellness is, well, what about consent? What about if the parties consent to it, to the non-Article III judge entering a final judgment? Does that have some effect? Well, interestingly, in the magistrate judge setting, it did. Because some time ago, 30 years ago, the Supreme Court decided, well, magistrate judges who otherwise couldn't preside over a civil case, you know, if the clerk made a mistake and gave you a magistrate judge on your civil case on the wheel without identifying the fact that you need to consent to the exercise of jurisdiction, It's clear that that judge couldn't enter a final judgment. It's required, the statute itself requires a magistrate judge, requires the consent of the parties. But if the parties give consent, why does a magistrate judge get to do it, other than the fact that Congress said it could, said that the bankruptcy or the magistrate judge could do it? Why does that solve the sort of the institutional problem of not having Congress setting up, unprotected by the constitutional protections, judges to exercise part of the judicial power? Well, the issue really in the current case, which I'll get to in a minute, comes down to what the Supreme Court decided in 1986 in a case called Schor, S-C-H-O-R, versus the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, in which under the Futures Trading Act, those non-Article III commissioners in the CFTC were allowed to enter essentially final judgment on a counterclaim in disputes between people who buy commodities and brokers if they consented. And that became the principle that decides wellness. Sharif was a bad guy, as debtors sometimes are. I hope I'm not telling anybody anything new in here. He had been a distributor of health and wellness products for this, probably also a bad organization, Wellness International Network. Sounds like a scam to me. And he had sued them. He had gotten into a dispute with them down in Texas where he was distributing their product, claimed that they were a pyramid scheme, sued them, and then basically paid no attention to the courts. He was sent discovery demands. He ignored them. He ignored them aggressively, ended up having summary judgment entered against him basically by default in a district court in Texas, and Wellness ends up with a $655,000 judgment against him in Texas. It then proceeds to try to collect it. Sharif, by now happily having moved to Chicago, decides that he will resist it by filing a Chapter 7 petition in the Northern District. And here's an interesting fact on page 6 of the outline, item 6. At the initial meeting of creditors, the Chapter 7 trustee asked him to produce documents relating to a loan application he had made to WAMU showing assets of $5 million. Well, and he admitted that he lied on that application and that $5 million in assets were held by a trust, of which he was a trustee, that they weren't really his. And really that's what this case is about. How do you get at this guy who's hidden whatever assets he had by putting them in a self-funded trust, a self-administered trust? And so Wellness, a creditor, files an adversary proceeding seeking to deny him a discharge for fraud and seeking a declaratory judgment that the trust was his alter ego and that it should be treated as property of the estate available for distribution to creditors. He didn't respond to the discovery requests in the adversary proceeding. Ends up having a default judgment entered against him in both the bankruptcy case and the adversary proceeding, and $60,000 in fees and costs awarded against him. He appeals to the district court, didn't raise any Stern issues. He did move for leave to file a supplemental brief after the Seventh Circuit's decision in the Ortiz case, Judge Kelly's case, which held that a bankruptcy court's order should only be treated as a report and recommendation. The district court said, too late, affirmed the bankruptcy court's decision. Case gets to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit affirms the decision with respect to the effect, to the denial of discharge, saying that's a core proceeding and a bankruptcy judge can make a final decision on, but reversed with respect to the finding that the trust was the alter ego and should be property of the estate. The Seventh Circuit thought that was a Stern claim, that is, a claim covered in the statute as a core claim, but unconstitutional because beyond the power of the bankruptcy judge under Northern Pipeline, and that implicated structural interests of Article III couldn't be waived, and sent it back to the district court to withdraw the reference and decide the case. So the issue presented to the Supreme Court when it agreed to hear this case is whether under Article III, bankruptcy courts may adjudicate claims for which litigants are constitutionally entitled to an Article III adjudication with the consent of the parties. Justice Sotomayor wrote the opinion of the court for herself and four others Justice Alito concurred in the result on different grounds, so it's a 6-3 decision in some respects. She just very straightforwardly said system won't run without bankruptcy and magistrate judges. She turned to Shore and the issue of adjudication by consent, found no problem with that. Because, in fact, that's what the case held, is if the waiver doesn't violate the Constitution's guarantee of checks and balances. And so the court also looked at some magistrate judge cases and said that consent blessed everything there, and so it should in this case, too, that allowing Article I courts to decide claims submitted to them by consent doesn't offend separation of powers, as long as the Article III judges retain supervisory jurisdiction over the Article I courts. It's always been an issue to me what that means. Well, you know, there are lots of powers in here that the district court has to withdraw the reference and do other things with respect to these cases. But, of course, they very seldom do, even to such things as the fact that bankruptcy judges and magistrate judges are appointed by Article III judges. So essentially the majority opinion, the opinion of the court, is that the parties may, by consent, allow the bankruptcy judges to enter final judgment in a situation in which they wouldn't be able to do so without consent. Essentially, I always wonder, I think we talked about it at the time, because we talked about Stern, I think, here when the case came down. What does it mean that Chief Justice Roberts said in the Stern decision that he wrote that that decision was a narrow one that did not change all that much? I always wondered, is he saying that with a nod and a wink? Was he saying it? It turns out, I think, that he said it because somebody in the wellness majority insisted on it being in there, and it has come back to be used against him in this case. Look, we told you in that case this wasn't going to change much. The court majority sort of waves to the side. Chief Justice Roberts' concerns about structural problems and says, you know, we got to get on with life. Consent is required. It's expressly required in the Magistrate Judges Act, and it is required now by this case in a bankruptcy case. Of course, you got to fill out the form that says, is this a court proceeding and do you consent? But it doesn't have to be in writing. It'd be better if it were. Justice Alito agreed that Article III isn't violated if a bankruptcy court resolves a Stern claim with the consent of the parties. He throws in a little idea that this isn't much different from arbitration, and we enforce arbitration all the time. I don't see any problem with it. Chief Justice, who wrote Stern, strong dissent.
Strong dissent. And the competing interest of making the court system run, making the federal judiciary a thing of value that actually can decide things versus constitutional principles is really at play here. And Justice Roberts kind of takes the constitutional issues and puts aside, as we'll see in his dissent, arguments that practicality really shouldn't drive constitutional decisions. He said, starts out and says, this isn't a Stern case. This isn't a Stern case. Getting the money that the debtor has in a trust is really stems from the bankruptcy. So Stern doesn't even apply. Majority stop there. We don't have to go any further. So long as there's no third-party claim on that money, the bankruptcy court has absolute jurisdiction to decide what's in the estate and how it gets divided up.
And Mr. Sharif's not a third party when he's arguing that he holds it as trustee instead of individually.
And the court goes on and says, well, you know, let's look at a prior case, the Samsil case, where there was an artificial corporation set up. It's really the debtor's second self, right? It's not a third party. It's not like a fraudulent transfer. where somebody else has the money and you've got to go get it. It's really the debtor's money kind of with an umbrella around it. And the court, that's significant to Justice Roberts. He said, absolutely, not a Stern case, don't have to go any further. Then he says, the majority goes on and says, we don't even care if it's a Stern issue or not. If there's consent, it's okay, we can decide it. And he takes real issue with that. He, you know, right out of the box, constitutional principles of separation of powers are violated. They're implicated in this case because there is an inappropriate attempt to take judicial power away from the courts of the United States. Congress can't do that. The court must strike down any attempt where the separation of powers is violated, even where two branches get together and agree. And he points to the line item veto, which both the Congress and the executive wanted to pass, and said, sounds like a real practical idea to me. Makes sense, but it violates separation of powers, and the branches can't by themselves change what is constitutionally required. Similar to the one house legislative veto. Two branches can't agree to abrogate what the Constitution requires. And if they can't, a private litigant certainly can't. Can't do that. He goes on and says that Shore really addressed whether consent can allow a non-Article III court to adjudicate a matter where constitutional principles are not implicated. He says they are implicated here. He says, I understand what Shore said, but in this case, they are implicated here. It really threatens the judicial integrity of the judicial branch, and that's inappropriate. He said consent it doesn't really change anything, and he goes back to the courts, the majority's discussion of Stern, where in Stern, Justice Roberts, writing for the majority, said, well, there wasn't really consent between Stern and Marshall. And the majority comes back and says, well, look at Northern Pipeline. There wasn't consent there. There wasn't consent in Stern. There is consent here, so it's okay. Marshall says, oh, that's really a red herring. There couldn't be consent in Stern, and that's really an inappropriate analysis of consent.
There couldn't be consent in Stern because the son,
right,
had no choice but to file his claim in the bankruptcy because of the automatic stay.
Yeah.
Tom always thought was a good argument.
As Tom said, the majority makes a lot of the supervision of the bankruptcy courts by Article III courts. You know, the reference is made. The reference can be withdrawn by the district court without sua sponte. The litigants can seek to have the reference withdrawn. Justice Roberts said, it doesn't matter. An Article III court cannot delegate Article III jurisdiction to a non-Article III court. And he goes on and says, you can't have an Article III jurisdiction, an Article III decision made by a state court or a moot court. Can't do it. Constitution doesn't allow it. He takes issue with Justice Alito's concurrence and said, you can't really compare a bankruptcy judge to an arbitrator because an arbitrator can't enforce its own award. Has to go to an Article III court to have that award enforced. And that's perfectly what the founders wanted. He talks about, he rejects the dire consequences that Tom alluded to in the majority opinion. The system wouldn't work. In the majority opinion at the outset, Justice Sotomayor says, look, here, there's more bankruptcy courts and more magistrate judges than are our district courts, and if they didn't work, they were unable to work, the system would break down. He goes on and says, convenience cannot trump the structural protections of the Constitution. He would not bend to the practicality rule. And he goes on and says, we already decided in executive benefits that the courts don't have to start over. If it's a stirred claim, the appellate court can treat the judgment as a finding and recommendation and continue with the case rather than starting at square one. While the Constitution encroachment may seem benign in this case, and here's the real crux of his decision, We don't know what Congress is going to do the next time, and it won't be in bankruptcy, but we'll be hard-pressed to turn back any attempt by Congress to reallocate judicial power to a non-Article III court. And that's the real issue here. The structural protections are only as strong as the Supreme Court is willing to enforce them, and here what he believes the majority has done is to say any judge can decide any issue that should be decided by an Article III court so long as the parties consent, and that's inappropriate. There's a recently published book that's really interesting. It's called The Quartet by Joseph Ellis, and he talks about the Constitutional Convention and the adoption of the Constitution moving from the Confederation, Articles of Confederation, to the Constitution. And he submits that, and Justice Roberts quotes James Madison in the opinion, and he submits that unlike the literal interpretation given by the conservative members of the court, the founders really, by compromise and political expediency, designed the Constitution to be a living document, to change over time, and points to the Federalist Papers and said, they're not dogma, although they're frequently quoted as that, they were a political means to get the Constitution adopted by the states. And he said, not more than that. So it's a really interesting book that kind of goes to some of the principles in this case. And Justice Thomas follows up with a dissent of his own, which I followed sort of, but maybe you can make more sense of it.
Well, he basically says, I can see that's what Shore says, that consent is good enough. Normally parties can consent to waive all kinds of rights. But if Shore says that parties could consent to the entry of judgment in a Stern case, it's wrong and should be overruled. And he also points out, I think correctly, how many issues the court decides in this case without having had any briefing on them. Is it even a Stern case, for example? Doesn't think this is the right case in which to decide these broad issues. That's what I drew out of it. Don't lose sight of the big picture here. Stern was a 5-4, and it had the Chief Justice, Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito. The Chief Justice lost Alito on this case. Alito is clearly a pragmatist on this issue, not as far out there as Justice Breyer. He also lost Justice Kennedy, who concurred in Justice Sotomayor's opinion, and Kennedy obviously can be pragmatic on this too. So we surely haven't heard the last of Stern. I don't think we're going to hear anything significant about it for a while. This is going to have to cook for a while. I think there's going to have to be some personnel changes on the court before there's any prospect of, all do what you're supposed to do now. Get your consents and move along, and that's going to be all right.
I think the majority said the other issue that Alito took issue with was whether implied consent is good enough, and the court said it is, but strongly admonished people to make sure that the consent is knowing and
voluntary
and documented, so there isn't any issue on appeal. The next case is really two cases, Bank of America versus Cauquette and Bank of America versus Toledo Cardana. And these cases come back to the plain meaning doctrine
right.
That Tom talked about just a minute ago.
With the little twist on it that the plain meaning that the court gave the statute in Doosnip seems to be wrong, but we're sticking to it,
which
is sort of the holding of Cauquette.
Exactly. The debtors in both cases had...
The unplain meaning.
The debtors in both cases had mortgages on property that on their houses, with Bank of America holding the second mortgage. The first mortgages in each case totally consumed the value of the property, so there was no value for the second mortgages. And the debtors in the Chapter 7 case moved the bankruptcy court to strip off the second mortgages, pointing to 506D, saying that to the extent the lien secured by a claim against the debtor is not an allowed secured claim, the lien is void. In both cases, it was acknowledged that Bank of America had an allowed claim under 502. In response to the motion, the bankruptcy court granted the motion, and the district court and the 11th Circuit affirmed. The issue was whether a debtor in a Chapter 7 proceeding may void a junior mortgage under Section 506D when the debt owed to the senior mortgage exceeds the present value of the property. Justice Thomas wrote the decision, and it was a plurality, all joined, some without respect to the footnote, which I'll mention in just a minute. Justice Thomas starts by saying 506A1 suggests that claims are only secured to the extent of value of the claimant's interest in the property. Given that the identical words used in 506A are used in 506D, it seems like the principle of the words in the same statute have the same meaning should apply. However, as Tom pointed out, in Doosnip versus Tim, the court provided a different construction and said that if a claim is allowed under 502 and there's a lien that's been granted to the claimant, whether or not the lien has value or not, it's outside of 506D. So under Doosnip's construction, the secured claim analysis resolves this issue in this case. He notes, and will note again a number of times, the debtors aren't asking us to overrule Doosnip. They took great pains to say, we're not asking you to overrule Doosnip. We're asking you to rule differently here because the facts are differently here. And he puts it in a footnote, and he lists at some length scholarly articles that severely criticize Doosnip, and it's in that footnote that some of the justices don't adopt that portion of the opinion.
Yeah, the footnote basically is a way of emphasizing the point of the opinion, which is, you know, we're going to stick with Doosnip because we decided that it's been criticized. Nobody's asked us to overrule it in this case. Nod, nod, wink, wink. And the footnote, as Pete says, lists all the scholarly criticisms of Doosnip. And that's the only part of the court's opinion that Justice Kennedy, who's the last surviving member of the majority in Doosnip, refuses to join. Right. So I don't know. I suspect they aren't going to be anxious to go back and reexamine that, but who knows. Baker Botts is the last case, and it's the one that surprised me, I think, although, again, I should be thinking about bedrock principles, right? Statutory interpretation, plain meaning. Calkett was a plain meaning case, and I think Baker Botts is a plain meaning case. A plain meaning case against the backdrop of the American rule, which is no fee shifting without express. So it's plain meaning, you know, with boots on. We only overrule the American rule if the legislative authority is clear. The legislative authority here, the issue here really was, as we talked about last year, this Baker Botts, which did a terrific job in this case of recovering several billion dollars in a fraudulent transfer case against the debtor's parent company. I wonder how difficult it was, but at any rate, got a ton of money, got paid all the fees it asked for, including a substantial success bonus, got praised by everybody under the sun, and wanted the last $5 million of its fees for contesting what was just a ridiculous fight by the parent company, now by the debtor, who's now back in the hands of the parent company following confirmation of the plan, since all the creditors got paid. And one wonders why the bankruptcy court didn't exercise a good deal more control over this fee litigation than it did. We note on page 15 of the outline that the parent objected to the fee request, forced Baker Botts to produce every document Baker Botts had received or sent during a 52-month bankruptcy, constituting 6 million pages. Well, somebody should have been talking to the bankruptcy judge about that, it seems to me, while it was going on. But that's why the bill got run up. And the question here is, does Baker Botts get to recover the $5 million or so that it incurred defending its fee application? And the Supreme Court says no, it doesn't. And it's interesting. It's a 5-4 decision. Ultimately, it's a plain meaning case. The statute doesn't. The statute does allow allows fees for preparing the fee petition, but it doesn't allow fees for defending against a challenge to the fee petition. And all the arguments about how unfair it is that, you know, that the debtor's counsel has to take on all comers, anybody can come in and complain about it, run up the bill, isn't enough. You got a beef, go to Congress. I think that's the court's holding, really.
Yep.
Whether you wanted to say anything more about that.
Nope. I mean, essentially, that's really what the court said. The court said plain meaning doctrine controls. The statute doesn't 330 doesn't allow fee shifting, unlike the case that they talk about, the commissioner versus Gene, that does allow fee shifting. He does point to section
equal one, access to justice case.
Yep.
Yeah.
110I in the bankruptcy code, which says that where there is, let me get the reference, there's that allows the debtor specifically to collect reasonable attorney's fees for moving to collect damages for fraudulent acts of petition preparers. Said, look at that section. That's a fee-shifting statute that does allow attorney's fees. 330 does not, and the plain meaning rule controls.
Or the bad faith filing of an involuntary,
exactly.
Another instance in which the statute allows.
Let me just mention, Judge, while we're talking about upcoming cases, no petitions have been granted this year, so maybe we got our ration last year. 23 petitions have been denied, 13 are pending, involving a whole host of issues, a number of discharge issues on the docket, a couple of Stern issues coming up. But so far, the court hasn't taken any of them.
Right. Well, yesterday they argued a Fair Credit Reporting Act case about damages, and if you don't have any bankruptcy cases, we'll maybe ask you guys to tell us about that one. So thanks so much for this great presentation. All my stuff is on the website, so make sure you check it if you haven't printed it off. Come back on December 8th, Bankruptcy Ethics, with Mark Metz, Olivia Reiner, and Paula Cookie. We'll see you in December. Thanks again.